Thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the November 24th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. African football's troubled era under Confederation President Ahmad Ahmad ended Monday when FIFA banned him from the sport for 5 years for financial misconduct. The disciplinary action by FIFA's ethics committee came during Ahmad's re-election campaign, which was clouded by accusations of corruption. For reaction, Iron Mike Mbonye called Johannesburg, where he reached African football analyst Emeka Enyadike.
The announcement of the ban on the president of CAF didn't come as a surprise to me, because this is one story that has been blowing hot and cold for, I would say, probably the last 2 years, because there were a lot of scenarios that played out during the FIFA Congress in Paris and his subsequent arrest and detention for a few hours, and then of course all the intrigues within CAF leading up to the AFCON and then post that. And then there's been a lot of undercurrents which has been there, and now, you know, with the elections in sight, there's always this FIFA ethics clearance that every candidate needs, and there was no way he wasn't going to get caught in it, because everything that he has been accused of, we've known for the last 2 years, and, you know, FIFA did not take action, so it seemed like it had blown over. But quite unfortunate, because this is a trend that has not boded very well for African football, and I think it's really, really time that something needs to be done.
What lessons can be learned for African football, given the offenses committed by Ahmad Ahmad?
You know what I find really surprising is how Africans just do not learn. You know, this whole scenario that has played out, seen a lot of Africans involved in the FIFA problems following the award of the World Cup to Qatar in 2010. There were a lot of African executives who were caught up in that. And through the years, including with the IAAF and some other IOC, there's always been this scenario where African executives cannot understand that when you get into these positions and you become the president of a confederation or even the president of an association, there are two words that should guide you, which is corporate governance. Corporate governance is not something that exists in Africa. Even on paper, it doesn't exist, because most of the African Federation presidents kind of behave like African heads of states who think that they're some kind of maximum rulers. They spend money and they take decisions without recourse to ethics and all the regulations that are there. And they make these approvals sometimes combination of ignorantly, or sometimes out of just sheer, you know, feeling like they are some kind of king. There needs to be a scenario where there has to be more tightening of corporate governance rules. And the time is now, because this is the year 2020 and we're still caught up in the same scenario that we found ourselves in 2010 and 1990 or the year 2000 or 1980. We just have to change.
Which way forward for CAF and African football?
I think the way forward for African football is that we need to do a clean sweep of some of these people that have been involved in football at that level. There needs to be a total re-education, total reorientation, and a total recalibration. There needs to be, incentives to invite in a bit more professionals into this. There are people, there are Africans who are passionate about football, who work in corporates, that can be attracted into CAF. I mean, I see Patrice Motsepe, who is a very successful businessman, is trying to vie for the CAF presidency. We need to bring in people there whose goal is not to look at, you know, what kind of resources and what they can do around it that's negative. We need to find people who will help improve the financial standing, and those who will come in there and manage also the resources. I think that's where we need to be looking at. And for Africa, you know, seriously, we need to bring in a bit more professionals into the running of football. Right now, it's a big mess, and some change needs to happen.
We have seen repeatedly African football executives being banned by FIFA. How can we produce professionals in CAF and other national football associations?
Yeah, the way we can do that, we can bring about professionalism has to be, you know, being able to do it at the grassroots level. At the national federation, FIFA spends a lot of money trying to help improve the professionalism within the federations, but for the most part, very little is done. So it has to go on within the countries where there has to be a seismic shift, where there has to be certain standards, certain qualification standards before you can vie for local FA positions, regional FA positions, and national FA positions. Because it's only when, you know, in competing, we call it garbage in, garbage out. If you put in the wrong people from that level, the way the football pyramid is structured is such that it's the same people who mismanage at the local level who then go on to regional level and then on to national level and then from there to sub-regional levels, and sometimes they even get skyrocketed into the presidency of CAF or the CAF executive committee. So we found a scenario where people go in there and they don't know what to do. You know, you can imagine that for the most part of last year, FIFA actually came and took charge of CAF because there was this whole scenario that so much had gone wrong. And it is from there that a lot of these issues were uncovered. And everyone's talking about Ahmad today. Ahmad is not the only one. They're all about the other members of the organization who got involved in it. So it's a problem that needs to be fixed across board. It's narrow where even the operating core, those who run the day-to-day management of the football associations, are not the professionals. There needs to be a lot more influx of professionals, bringing management, bringing financial professionals, bringing real operating people from industry who can come in. And this has to start from the local FAs within the various countries, because it is from there. They are the ones who rise to the national level, and from there they get on to the sub-regional bodies, and then they get on to CAF Executive Committee. For the past, I would say, 63 years, because CAF's about that old, we've seen continuously, maybe even in the 60s it was a lot better, but I would say from late 70s right through to, or maybe the 80s right through to the present time, there's just been not enough quality. And this is an opportunity for us to try and do it, because it's one suspension too many for Africa.
That's African football analyst Emeka Enyadike. And he spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Hi, my name is Emeka Enyadike from the City of Gold, Johannesburg. I want to say a big shout out to the Sun Inside of Sports. Thank you.
Thank you, Emeka. Now let's go to Accra, where the arrival of a Brazilian footballer has fans talking in Ghana's Premier League. Joining us now from Accra is Yao Afusu-Larbi. Sporty greetings, Yao.
Sporty greetings, Sunny. The Ghana Premier League is already two games in, but the excitement has reached a crescendo. After the return of Ghana's record scorer Asamoah Gyan to the league, one of Ghana's biggest clubs, Asante Kotoko, have brought in a Brazilian player, Fabio Gama. Kumasi Asante Kotoko have not won the league in 5 years and will be looking to get there with their new man. But the club's love affair with Brazilians dates back to 2005. In that year, they brought in three. Their names, Uli de Castro Rodriguez, Gleison de Souza Ferreira, and Fabio Luiz Rodriguez da Silva. The three could not quite work out for the club. They left after playing a handful of games and didn't quite make the impact many were expecting from them. Then in 2014, another followed. Hermes da Silva came in and never quite played any game before he had to return to Sao Paulo, where he came from. Now with the new boy, the expectations are high and he seems to understand what it means.
Now I come to training individual, so I'm not 100% yet, but soon I will be when I get started training with the team. And I come to play, I think, 15, 20, 30 minutes. And I hope to be very so soon to help my teammates to do a great season.
As a boy, Fabio Gama's career trajectory looked great. He started out as one of Brazil's brightest talents. He even represented the Seleção at youth level. But that looked to be the beginning of the end for him. Injuries, unstable contracts, and wrong choices meant he will be left as a young journeyman whose peripatetic career has become a bane for his growth. He played in the youth teams of Botafogo, for Botafogo themselves, EC Bahia, and then at SC Gama. Before he joined the Ghana Premier League, he was on the books of Swedish side Jönköping. A fresh page has been handed to him in Ghana's second city, Kumasi, and he is looking to take it with both hands. Gama says his aim is to win the league and the African version of the Champions League, which Asante Kotoko have not won since 1983.
I will speak the truth for you, and I want to be champions here. I come to here not just to play. I come to here to be champions of the Champions League and the Premier League too. And I want to very much be champions with this great club, with this beautiful shirt. And the most important thing to me is be champions.
On Sunday, Patrick Kipingano of Nakero County clocked 15 minutes, 37.05 seconds to win the men's title. Kipingano said his victory during Sunday's event in Naivasha is enough to fight for a place in the Kenyan national team.
Yeah, it is international for us. I've been running also in Europe, some cross country, but not the mountain. But with this one, it is classic.
Francesca Kanda won the women's 8-kilometer race in 48 minutes, 11.5 seconds ahead of compatriots Beatrice Chizarik and Judith Koriri. Staying with athletics, two-time Olympic champion in the 800 meters, South Africa's Caster Semenya says she is being targeted by World Athletics over regulations that require her to artificially lower her natural testosterone levels because she is undefeated. Caster Semenya is set to lodge an appeal at the European Court of Human Rights to challenge the rule, having previously lost two legal appeals against the World Athletics' highly contentious regulations.
I can't say I'm targeted because of I'm an African black woman. What I can say is that I'm targeted because I'm undefeated. If you don't want women, just scratch them out of competitions, and then we'll go sit there and do whatever we do best. Because now you're going to categorize. What is it that you're categorizing?
Greg Knott, the lawyer who has represented a South African for more than a decade, offered no time frame for the challenge at a Strasbourg-based court.
And for a young person, she turns 30 in January. She has an indomitable spirit and very, very strong in terms of her willpower, her strength of mind, her strength of being, and her absolute discipline.
World Athletics has argued high testosterone gives Semenya and others an unfair advantage over athletes with testosterone in the typical female range. In boxing news, Ghanaian Richard Latte suffered a brutal second-round knockout in the hands of Fabio Wadley in the second round of their scheduled heavyweight 10-rounder at Wembley. Fabio Wadley prolixed his latest victim, Richard Latte, leaving the Ghanaian heavyweight needing oxygen. After getting his range in the opening round, Wadley took him out with a single shot in the second round.
We got through that first round. I kind of figured out what I was going to do from then onwards. And I stung him with a few jabs, and I always saw that them gloves always came straight up front in front of him. So I thought, sting him with one, come around the sides, and that was the plan, and it came off perfectly.
I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria.
Hello, listeners. My name is Juma Miro, the Commonwealth Games bronze medalist in Australia 2018. Listen to Southern Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
One of our big basketball stories this year was the release of the 10-part Michael Jordan documentary series titled The Last Dance. The series chronicled Jordan's career and how he became a global cultural icon and a 6-time NBA champion. I asked sports journalist and Sunny Side of Sports contributor Dan Friedel, did the documentary change your opinion of Michael Jordan and his basketball legacy?
Sonny, I think that seeing Michael Jordan at the height of his powers, you know, he came onto the American landscape as a university player in North Carolina, his home state, in the early 1980s, and was drafted by the Chicago Bulls, who were a really bad team when he was young, and lifted them up, and the team went through a couple of different coaches. It's really interesting to see the video of Michael Jordan when he was at the height of his powers in the late 80s, all the way through the late 1990s. And think about how he would fit in with today's NBA. And I feel like he would be extremely competitive now. You know, one of the things that I remembered is that in the late 1980s, even though the three-point shot was a part of the NBA landscape, you know, players like Steve Kerr, who is the current Golden State Warriors head coach, he was known as a sharpshooter. He was like the Steph Curry of his day. He came off the bench, and they would feed him the ball and try to get him to make a few of these long-range shots, and he would take maybe only 4 or 5 three-pointers a game, and he was one of the best outside shooters of that era. You know, now you have players like Steph Curry shooting 20 times from long range, and one of the most outstanding games that Michael Jordan played early in his career was a playoff loss to the Boston Celtics when the Celtics were one of the top teams in the NBA, competing with the Los Angeles Lakers and the Philadelphia 76ers for NBA superiority. He scored 63 points in that game. So, Sonny, the amazing thing about that game, 63 points, no three-pointers. Michael Jordan was such an outstanding shot maker, but he did it all inside, in the traffic, driving to the lane and making like the most inefficient shots that people consider these days are these shots that are 15 to 18 feet away from the basket. And that was his bread and butter when it was early in his career. He was just such an interesting, unique player. And then the fact that as his career progressed, he continued getting better is really remarkable.
Dan, you mentioned that game against the Celtics, that 63-point scoring outburst. And it reminded me, Larry Bird described Jordan as a rookie, that he was the best basketball player he had ever seen. Pretty high praise from Larry Bird, himself a Hall of Fame player. But I think if we look at the record books, Dan, Jordan played in 6 NBA finals. He won 6 NBA championships. And in each of those finals, he was named the most valuable player of the series. So just incredible in terms of rising to the occasion. Jordan always seemed to be at his best when the stakes were the highest.
You know, Sonny, one of the games that I remember so vividly, it was May 7th, 1989, that Michael Jordan defeated my hometown Cleveland Cavaliers with a last-second shot in Game 5 of the first round of the playoffs. I was caught off guard because I was celebrating, thinking the Cavs were going to win and advance to the next round of the playoffs. And with a fraction of a second left in the game, Michael Jordan made the game-winning shot and dagger through my teenage heart at that point. But there's no doubt about it that, you know, if the game was on the line and you needed to win, you put the ball in the hands of Michael Jordan. He even did that in a college championship game when he was a 19-year-old. He had that ability to focus and make the shot as if he was playing in his North Carolina backyard with his father. It was really pretty amazing player. And it's so great to relive these games that were part of my formative NBA fandom watching this documentary.
What are some of the takeaways about Jordan maybe that either surprised you or you learned some new things about MJ personality-wise?
You know, I think that there's one thing about him, and that was that he's, you know, he wasn't perfect, right? He was, you could consider that maybe he was perfect on the basketball court, right? In his generation, for 20 years, he was the best player in the NBA. Some people might argue that Wilt Chamberlain was a transcendent player. That was the conversation then, and now here we are, we're talking about LeBron James. Maybe LeBron James is the greatest player ever. There's no doubt that he was kind of like the perfect basketball specimen. But it's interesting to learn a little bit more about him now that I'm an adult, right? When I was 13 or 14 years, I wasn't able to really put this into perspective. But now that I'm in my 40s, I can say, yeah, you know, Michael Jordan wasn't perfect, right? He had an amazing platform to maybe engender some change in the world by potentially taking some political stances, and he always declined that. He did have a gambling problem. He wound up having to spend a lot of money to cover gambling debt. So, you know, he wasn't a perfect man off the floor. And that's something I didn't really recognize as a teenager. It actually makes him a little bit more human, right? Because in 1987 to 1997, you know, he was like a god. But to look back, 30 years have gone by, to see how he evolved, and get a little bit of a sense of what it was like in his personal life during those years is really interesting to me. And I actually have kind of enjoyed learning about Michael Jordan's flaws.
I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. I'm talking with Dan Friedell about the Michael Jordan documentary, The Last Dance. Dan, a few days after the documentary was released, a pair of sneakers worn by Michael Jordan during his rookie season were auctioned off for $560,000. Dan, any thoughts on Michael Jordan and his footwear?
I think it's been about 35 years that the Air Jordan shoe has been on the market. And there was an episode of the documentary that discussed how his agent brought him around to these big shoe companies in the mid-80s to kind of say, hey, this guy is going to be a hero. It's time to get on the Michael Jordan train. And in that era, the big shoe company in the NBA was Converse. Players like Magic Johnson and Larry Bird wore Converse shoes. And Converse was known as the basketball shoe, the gym shoe, you know, going way back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. In pop culture at the time, Adidas was a big deal. If you remember, hip-hop groups like Run DMC were wearing Adidas shoes with the tongue out and no shoelaces. So for him, a young African-American man, he was identifying with the Adidas brand, and Adidas as a company was struggling. So they certainly didn't have hundreds of thousands of dollars to devote to marketing this. You know, he was a great college player, but nobody knew he was going to become Michael Jordan. So the third choice was Nike. And Nike was this company in Oregon that had made its name in the track and field world and the long distance running world. But it wasn't really known as a basketball shoe company. But they decided to get on board. You know, you had the executive, Phil Knight, and they made a deal, and it was probably turned out to be one of the best endorsement deals in history for Nike early on. I think there was a statistic that said something like a successful deal for Nike would have been to sell maybe $500,000 worth of Air Jordan shoes in the first year, and the number turned out to be, you know, 10 or 20 times more than that. Like, it was like $20 million worth of Air Jordan shoes came out of this early part of the partnership between Nike and Michael Jordan. And then on and on and on. Of course, you know, at one point, I think his endorsement contract with Nike was worth way more than his salary with the Chicago Bulls.
He won six NBA titles during his playing career, and yet he hasn't been quite so successful in management. I think now he's with the Charlotte Hornets, primary owner, and they've basically been either a mediocre or losing team under his managerial role. Any thoughts?
And actually, I was reading an article just the other day about how, you know, in the 1992 Olympics, Charles Barkley was arguably the best player on that Olympic dream team. And Michael Jordan was obviously Michael Jordan, but in the actual games themselves, Charles Barkley had better statistics and was the more dominating player. and they really became great friends during those 1992 Olympic Games and the training camp leading up to the Barcelona Olympics. And they've been friends for, you know, decades after that, while they were playing against each other. And then Charles Barkley got into working in television. But Barkley has been critical of Jordan's ability to be the driving force behind the Charlotte Hornets. You know, we talk on this show all the time about the job that Masai Ujiri has done with the Toronto Raptors. And, you know, he has made a name for himself as a great executive. Michael Jordan has kind of been the opposite, which is really interesting to think about, because as a player, he hated to lose. It seems like as an executive, he might not be able to show the same killer instinct that he did when he was making all those game-winning shots.
Interesting you bring up Barkley. Maybe we can close with Sir Charles. Barkley, of course, one of more than a few players foiled by Michael Jordan during his career. I think of Barkley never won an NBA title, Dan. John Stockton, Karl Malone with the Jazz, all foiled to a certain degree by having the misfortune of playing in the same era as Michael Jordan.
That's absolutely right. There's very few athletes like that who played so many years at such a high level that they basically locked down the championships in their particular sports. And like, one of the other athletes that I've thought about as far as this goes is somebody like Michael Phelps, right? Michael Phelps was so good in all of these Olympic swimming events and won so many medals that there were amazing swimmers, even from the United States, that didn't even get to win these gold medals, let alone swimmers from countries like Australia and Italy and other big swimming countries around the world. But sure, Karl Malone, John Stockton, you know, even some of these great players that I grew up enjoying, part of the Cleveland Cavaliers rotation, a player like Mark Price. For a while, it looked like Ron Harper wasn't going to win a title, but Ron Harper started winning when he became a member of the Bulls. It's really interesting for me to look at some of the highlights from these games. Patrick Ewing is an example. It's interesting to look at some of the highlights from some of these games and see the outstanding players that were on the floor. Reggie Miller, players like that who you think, gosh, you know, these were in the top 5 or 10 of the league, and they just were unlucky to play in the time of Michael Jordan and not be able to hoist the championship trophy. It's really been a lot of fun to watch these episodes of the documentary and see him on the floor doing what he did, and some of the behind the scenes material is really great, and I hope that our listeners do get a chance to see it.
Dan, I also hope our Voice of America listeners get a chance to see The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan basketball documentary series. And thanks to Dan Friedel for joining us on the show. This Sunny Side of Sports programming note, I'll be taking a Thanksgiving break. Prince Nesta will be hosting the show on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. The November 24th edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Joe Palca. Americans got their first look at President-elect Joe Biden's proposed national security team today. During a speech in Wilmington, Delaware, Mr. Biden said that his team would embody, quote, my core beliefs that America is strongest when it works with its allies.
is a team that will keep our country and our people safe and secure. And it's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it.